Welcome to the Holistic Matters podcast series. In this episode of Medicinal Herbs, naturopath and medical herbalist Amanda Williams joins host Sarah Labrum-Bloschka to talk about hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's disease, and the role played by herbs in addressing these conditions of the thyroid.
Excited to have Amanda Williams, herbalist from Australia, with us again today to have a discussion about the thyroid. And we'll focus mostly on the condition of Hashimoto's. But let's start, Amanda, with this idea of like, how big is the size of the problem in regards to thyroid conditions?
Well, thanks so much, Sarah, for having me back again. I love talking about the thyroid and in particular Hashimoto's. So the size of the sort of thyroid problem, if you like, in the United States is that more than 12% of the US population will develop a thyroid condition at some point in their lifetime. And the most common thyroid condition is hypothyroidism. So that's a low thyroid function. Furthermore, up to 60% of these people with a thyroid condition are completely unaware that something is going awry. So they're not aware that they have a thyroid condition. So therefore, they may be experiencing a whole range of different symptoms, but not be aware of what the causative factor is. Subclinical hypothyroidism, which is where you're not really seeing distinct pathological markers on a blood test, is in about 8% of women and 3% of men. So generally, thyroid conditions affect women more than men. And subclinical hypothyroidism often goes undiagnosed, but it's important that we recognize subclinical hypothyroidism because it can progress to overt hypothyroidism. So it sort of is the starting point potentially in many patients to that overt thyroid low function. And Hashimoto's thyroiditis is the most common form of hypothyroidism. And in the past 30 years, its incidence has really increased. And more than 10% of women that's been shown in the studies have positive thyroid antibodies, i.e. they have an autoimmune condition, they have Hashimoto's. But in my practice, and I'm sure for a lot of the doctors that are listening, I see more than 10% of my patients with Hashimoto's because I'm doing the appropriate testing. You know, 2% of patients in the studies have shown manifestations, i.e. they've got the clinical symptoms of hypothyroid or Hashimoto's, but they do have the disease. So it's almost, I think of it like a stealth missile from a submarine. It's coming through the water and you can't see that it's coming. And then all of a sudden you've got the full-blown Hashimoto's. So it is really important that we as clinicians are testing our patients appropriately, and in particular for women in postmenopause, because the disease prevalence increases with age. So very important that we are aware of this and that we know that we need to be, you know, checking our patients thoroughly and looking at the blood, you know, blood markers as well.
So Amanda, as we kind of like we're talking around it, maybe it would be good for us to define what is Hashimoto's thyroiditis and how would we identify it when we're testing for it?
Certainly. So it's a condition that's been around for a long time. So it was first recognized and defined in 1912, so well over 100 years. And it was first described by Dr. Hakuru Hashimoto. And he saw the lymphocytes infiltrating the thyroid gland. So this is the autoimmune manifestation. So the immune system is attacking the thyroid itself. So it's, you know, when we talk about it's a thyroid problem, no, it's a whole body problem. It's an autoimmune condition. And so you've got this lymphocytic infiltration, and then you end up eventually with fibrosis and atrophy of the thyroid gland. But it's happening throughout the body as well, because the thyroid hormones are critically important for every sort of organ system in the body, including the heart, the central nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, your gastrointestinal system, even your bones and your metabolism, and much more. So if something's attacking the thyroid, i.e. the immune system's attacking the thyroid, then you're going to have problems in many different aspects of your bodily functions. On a blood test, what doctors need to be looking for is more than TSH. So you need a comprehensive thyroid panel. So I hear many doctors talking about, well, TSH was in normal range. That's irrelevant, you know, and it's definitely in the published research that TSH is not a relevant marker. So what you might see, first of all, is if your patient comes to you for the first time and they've got a blood test from their primary physician and it's got TSH on it, you may see that TSH is over 2. So at first point, you're saying, okay, well, it may be over 2, but really healthy sort of range is between 1.3 and 3 at the very most. We never want it up near 3, really, because as soon as TSH starts to rise, you know there's a problem with the thyroid. You also, critically for Hashimoto's, need to have the thyroid antibodies. So you'll have elevated levels of something called thyroid peroxidase antibodies, and often that looks like TPOAB, so thyroid peroxidase antibodies, and thyroglobulin antibodies, and that's TGAB. Now, I know for some of you that may be listening that are not familiar with a thyroid panel, this might sound confusing, but it's really very simple. You look, first of all, at TPO. That's your main driver, or your main initial signal that there's a problem with the immune system attacking the thyroid. So your normal sort of range for TPO antibodies is 0 to 6.8. If it's over that, then you've got a problem. You know that there's an issue. And you don't necessarily need to have a goiter to know that there's a problem with hyperthyroidism, right? So don't look only for a goiter. Look on the blood tests. And for more sort of detailed information on the blood tests and, you know, everything to do with Hashimoto's, I have done a masterclass on the thyroid immune puzzle, which is for doctors and gives you all of the published research. So there must be those thyroid antibodies. And what you'll see is this really puzzling picture with TSH, free T4, and free T3, it's not always the same. So you could be testing every 3 months and they might be all over the place, sometimes up, sometimes down. But it's the antibodies you need to zero in on to know whether it's Hashimoto's, because with Hashimoto's, you can have hyper and hypothyroid symptoms at the same time, or you can fluctuate between hypo and hyper. So that's why it is the thyroid immune puzzle, because it doesn't always look like a textbook picture of hypothyroidism.
So if you see this kind of like combination sometimes of hyper and hypo, they have very different symptomology, right? But, you know, if you have somebody coming in and saying, you know, I have XYZ symptoms, what are some of those key XYZ symptoms? Or is it really just getting to the heart of it through testing and you realize through the symptomology you see it's something with the thyroid?
That's a great question. I mean, many of us have patients that may or may not wish to invest in testing. So often the first place we start is by taking a very detailed case history. And so some of the classic sort of hypothyroid, which are also Hashimoto's symptoms as well, that we would be looking at are fatigue and lethargy is your biggest one. Now, we all get tired at times, so let's delineate between Hashimoto's and hypothyroidism fatigue. It is fatigue that is unrelenting. You wake up tired, all day you're tired, you literally get home from work, for example, or from university, whatever it might be, and you collapse on the couch. You can't even be bothered half the time to make a meal, so you just grab something and all you want to do is go to bed. But then it repeats again the next day and the next day. So you literally feel like you are dragging yourself through life. So if a patient is saying these things to you, you need to be thinking, oh, I need to be doing a thyroid panel. The other things are cold intolerance. Now, these things don't always need to be present, but they may be present, okay? So you don't have to have a tick for all of these. So cold intolerance, weight gain due to unknown causes, constipation, impaired cognitive function. So they've got that real slowness to respond, or they've got the constant brain fog and struggling to really think things through. Depression is very often present. Real muscle weakness. So they feel that everything is exhausting, even sort of carrying the groceries from, you know, the store to the car or whatever. They are exhausted and they really struggle to pick heavy things up. Glucose metabolism dysregulation. Infertility issues, and this is where it's picked up in a lot of women, is when they're going through difficult times to get pregnant and they might see a doctor and then they, you know, it will be picked up that there's over hypothyroidism and Hashimoto's, and various gut issues, especially achlorhydria. So they'll be really struggling with things like reflux and feeling awfully bloated after meals, and, you know, just that real slow transit time and so on. IBS, anemia is very, very often present. And the other thing I've noticed as well is urticaria. So if you've got a patient with spontaneous urticaria, always check their thyroid. And even vertigo is very common as well. So they're just some of the signs and symptoms you might see. However, in the elderly, you've got fewer signs. So they'll have the more overt Hashimoto's, but they'll have fewer signs for you to pick up on in a case taking. So always check at least once a year in an elderly patient their thyroid function through a comprehensive panel. And as I said before, the symptoms in Hashimoto's can fluctuate between hypo and hyperthyroidism. And there's some interesting studies that have been done where in one study, 15% of patients with Hashimoto's were completely asymptomatic. They didn't have any of the typical hypothyroid symptoms. And in another study of 250 women with a mean age of around 63, what they found was that these women had no prior diagnosis of thyroid disease at all, but 38% of them had autoimmune. So they had Hashimoto's, and 26% had hypothyroid. So they didn't have autoimmune, but they had low thyroid function. So that means out of those 250 women, 64% of them were undiagnosed with a thyroid condition and they needed treatment and help for that. So in my opinion, you cannot diagnose Hashimoto's or hypothyroidism on symptoms alone, you've got to have the blood test. So first of all, do your case taking and your symptoms, etc. But always consider in women to do a thyroid panel at some point in the process of the care with that patient.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it seems like a very complex, right? Because it can present in multiple ways. And especially in that younger woman with all those other symptomology, like you could be confused with other conditions. So you really need to have that thyroid if you're suspecting it. Because I mean, yes, it kind of in some ways sounds similar to PCOS or other, you know, conditions,
yes,
especially in that younger age.
Yes, it does, definitely. And I talk to patients about it being a great imitator, and that we could spend a lot of money trying to treat a whole raft of different potential issues, working our way through phased programs. But if we just do some decent blood work, we then get a signpost for the direction that we need to take, and it gives us clarity. Now, the blood tests don't define your treatment program, but they give you an understanding of what is there and where to from here. So it's like you're starting directions in your map app. This is the road you start to take now, and then you define that based on the patient's response over time to how you're working with them.
So that leads us to kind of like our next thing. So what would be that kind of clinical, functional, herbal approach to Hashimoto's? How would you treat those patients? And I'm sure maybe symptomology kind of, if it's presenting as hyper or hypo, maybe it's slightly different.
So the key things are with the functional herbal therapy, which is, you know, the system that Professor Kerry Bone has defined, which really helps us understand how to work at a system and a causative factor level. So it's well worth sort of looking into this approach a bit more yourself for all the doctors listening. But in regards to Hashimoto's in particular, what I've done is I've taken Kerry Bone's approach and defined it for Hashimoto's. And the great thing about this is you tailor it to every individual patient. So I'm going to give you the sort of, I guess, the outline of options. And there are some things you must do with every patient, but there are others that you can choose according to that individual. And the one thing I always do with every patient is focus on the things that are bothering them the most. So initially, so for example, if sleep is a big issue for them, or their brain fog is a big issue, obviously I'm going to work on the Hashimoto's, but I'm going to address cognitive function as a priority, for example. So in the initial stages, what we need to do for Hashimoto's is address the thyroid function itself to support healthy thyroid function. And we do that with some herbs that really help not only for the thyroid, but have other aspects as well. So we'll go into a couple of those in a bit more detail after we cover the whole framework. But bladderwrack, ashwagandha, and bacopia are my three main ones that I use in combination for all thyroid low function patients, so hypothyroid and Hashimoto's. And I'll talk about those in a bit more after we've gone through this. Then the second thing you need to consider is supporting a healthy immune response. So the immune response has become dysregulated and is attacking the thyroid gland, but also it's dysregulated everywhere else potentially. So the ones that we use for that are, of course, echinacea root to modulate that immune response. And then to modulate the inappropriate response of the immune system, we use hemidesmus, Romania, and bupleurum, and also feverfew. So they can all really help to calm that overactive immune response. So just by tackling the thyroid and the immune response, we're covering a big aspect of that disease manifestation and disease progression of Hashimoto's. And immune-driven inflammation is a big issue. And typically with autoimmune of any kind, we've always got to address inflammation. And my favorite there is bioavailable curcumin from turmeric. And personally, what I use in my practice is a curcumin that is combined with fenugreek galactomannosides, because it's been shown in the research to deliver more free unconjugated curcuminoids into the bloodstream. So therefore, you've got better bioavailability and distribution into various tissues of the body, and also crosses the blood-brain barrier, which is great because depression is a cofactor normally with Hashimoto's, and that's a neuroinflammatory condition. So by using bioavailable curcumin, we can have some support for that. And then what we need to do as a priority is address the drivers of this sort of chronic immune dysfunction. So that might be, and this is where your case taking is going to be really key, it might be chronic dysbiosis, it might be persistent stealth pathogens, which is what I find in most Hashimoto's patients, and there has been a correlation with Hashimoto's and Epstein-Barr virus as a causative factor. So always addressing stealth pathogens. And toxins have been a big issue shown in the research for Hashimoto's, and metabolic imbalances and diet. You know, you've got to do a low danger autoimmune anti-inflammatory diet as part of your program with your patient. So always, always at some point in my treatment process with my patients that have Hashimoto's, I do the stealth pathogen protocol. And normally I find it, I can introduce it by about month 4 of working with the patient. So prior to that, I'm working on the key things that I've just discussed, the immune system, the inflammation, and the thyroid, and whatever is really bothering them, the brain fog, the depression, the sleep issues, whatever it might be, and getting them feeling better. And you would be very surprised just by doing those things alone and sorting out their diet, how much better they can feel just within a couple of months. So by month 4, I'm ready to implement the stealth pathogen program. And I do that for 3 months. And that really seems to make a huge difference, even within a month. But don't stop it at a month. Continue it for 3. So you do it for the full 3 months, no matter how much better they might be feeling after 4 weeks or 6 weeks. So the key thing here is that you're working on the drivers that might be driving that dysregulated immune response that's attacking the thyroid. And what we also need to consider is optimizing digestive function, because achlorhydria is in most Hashimoto's patients, is present in most. So you can do that through bitter tonics. And I have done another podcast called Bitter Bonanza. So check that out if you're not familiar with bitter tonics. So things like gentian and wormwood and feverfew. And they can just take those just 15 minutes before meals, and it will really stimulate their body's own digestive capacity, manage blood sugar, improve satiety, and many, many other benefits. And they've also been shown to be important for the immune response as well. Our immune cells have bitter receptors, so there's lots of benefits from bitters. One thing I want to talk about with Hashimoto's patients is their diet. As I mentioned, they need to be doing an autoimmune anti-inflammatory diet. Now, that can be a nightmare for a patient who is so fatigued and it's just struggling to get through the day. So I'm really gentle about how I introduce this with patients, and I make sure that it's workable for them. And you need to ensure that they can implement it. So what I typically suggest to patients is just maybe cook some food on the weekend and have that ready for the week. So package it up into meals for the week so that you can then just literally reheat, which I know probably a lot of people listening to this might be thinking, what about the nutrient factor, et cetera, when you're reheating food? I would say it's better than nothing. It's better than them, you know, dialing out for food delivery or grabbing a burger on the way home, that they get good veggies and good nutrition from a home cooked meal. So even if they can just do that on the weekend, nothing elaborate, very simple. For most of my Hashi's patients initially, it's the same meal every day of the week. But as long as they've got as many veggies in that as possible, I don't care. So that's a tip that I always give to patients to help improve their nutrition. And by taking the bitters, you're increasing their nutrient assimilation as well. And then after that, you just need to address the individual issues for that patient. So it might be their mood, it might be cognitive issues, etc. So at some point in the process, you need to address toxin exposure. And now, I don't do this initially, but later in the process, maybe about month 4 or 5, I have a consultation with them about sort of cleansing everything in their home progressively. Because before that, I find most people aren't ready for it. You know, they're just too overwhelmed in trying to do everything you ask them to do. So it's a progressive thing of, for women, cleaning up your makeup, you know, making sure that you're getting rid of toxic body products, makeup, home products, et cetera, so that they can really ensure that they're not slathering on loads of toxic stuff onto their skin or in their shower, et cetera. And they can do that progressively, because obviously it's expensive to change everything out at once. And you can look at the EWG.org website for ideas for how to implement this with your patients. And also they have an app that is great for patients to download, a free app, to get ideas of what things they could buy in the grocery store. So, and then at some point later on, when the patient's feeling much better, you can do a beautiful detox. So like a 21-day purification program is lovely to do, but they need to be ready for that, because it may be too overwhelming when they're not well and they're exhausted. In the meantime, you can obviously improve things in their diet. So you can, for example, get them drinking green tea. You can increase the amount of garlic that they're eating. You know, they can add rosemary to their food. So all the things that help upregulate NRF2 is perfect for a Hashimoto's patient. So they're sort of some of the main things in terms of overall functional herbal therapy and dietary approaches I would recommend.
You know, I like the concept, and I know when we've talked with Carrie about functional herbal therapy and this kind of modular thinking, like, you know, you got to kind of do things in stages. And I think that's so important. And one of the stages you kind of talked about was HPT access, so hyperpituitary thyroid access. So could you maybe just dive a little bit into what herbs specifically would support that?
Yeah, certainly. So it's mainly 3 key herbs that I use, but there are others, but these are the ones that I found work really well. And then these are sort of like my lead singers, and then I might have some backup band members as well. So my lead singers are bladderwrack, bacopa, and ashwagandha. So let's talk about bladderwrack, because I think it's a fascinating little plant. It's a shore-dwelling seaweed, and it's found in temperate climates such as the Pacific Ocean, and it's totally different to deep sea kelp. It has these little sort of vesicles, like little bladders, that help keep it near the surface of the sea. And it's interesting because we don't really understand what these vesicles are doing and why they do, why they sort of stand upright and keep the plant near to the surface. But it obviously, I think, has to do something with sunlight and photosynthesis or something. But this seaweed has the really rich in trace minerals, and it's actually the highest antioxidant level of all edible seaweeds. So it's really important, not only for thyroid function from a increasing T3, particularly in studies it's shown, but it also can help with those endogenous antioxidant defenses because it contains so many antioxidants. So it's been shown in studies to decrease intracellular reactive oxygen species and lipid peroxidation. It increases glutathione levels and superoxide dismutase levels as well. So here we've got our own antioxidant processes happening in the body, which all help with the immune response. And it's also been shown that it helps to sort of normalize the function of the thyroid gland in hypothyroidism. So it's really important for us to use, but caution with this bladderwrack, because there are lots of bladderwrack extracts around and products, etc. And part of the reason we use it is it contains iodine, but a plant-based bioavailable iodine, much better than using an iodine sort of supplement per se, because this is a plant-based iodine and shown to be, you know, much safer and more bioavailable. But the amount of iodine in the bladderwrack really depends on the quality of the bladderwrack. So you want to be sure that you're using a supplement that's got the amount of iodine from bladderwrack on the label, so you know what you're using. And then the next herb is bacopa. Now, we know bacopa for the brain. So I always say to patients, you know, bacopa is your brain herb, like ginkgo, but works in different ways. But bacopa has also been shown in experimental studies to support the thyroid function. So importantly, increasing T4 if T4 is low. So what that's showing is that you've got better function of the thyroid gland, right? If you've got better output of T4. And it also has been shown to have antioxidant function by increasing superoxide dismutase and catalase activity. But in many Hashimoto's patients, as I mentioned earlier, they have brain fog and cognitive dysfunction. So bacopa is perfect. And it's been shown in studies to enhance neuroplasticity, improves memory, increases BDNF, so brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which I describe to my patients as miracle grow for the brain. And also with the memory part, I just want to share sort of some clinical sort of learnings, I guess, from bacopa that I got very early on in my clinical career. Was patients were telling me that they were remembering things that they had forgotten long ago, like names of school friends that, or old phone numbers that they had as a child, and, you know, long, long forgotten memories they were now remembering. And even in my older patients, sort of in their 70s and 80s, they were finding that their memory was so much better, not just short term, but long term as well. So bacopa is fantastic for the brain, and I use it always with the bladderwrack for Hashimoto's patients. And it has been shown to be a great nervine tonic, calming the nervous system. So it's a classic nootropic herb. And then the final sort of lead singer is ashwagandha. We use ashwagandha for many, many things, and we know it really well as a fabulous adaptogen, but it's also been shown to support the thyroid function, even in subclinical hypothyroidism. In a study, they took ashwagandha for 8 weeks and statistically significant increase in T4 and T3 and lowered TSH as it was raised. And also the authors concluded that ashwagandha normalized the thyroid hormone levels in those patients. And then even in another study for bipolar disorder, they found that some of those patients had abnormal thyroid function and it normalized it. So they found that it helped to sort of improve how the thyroid function gland worked, but they didn't know the mechanism for that. So how it worked in the thyroid gland, they didn't know. But the upshot for us as clinicians is it helped. So ashwagandha, bacopa and bladderwrack, and then all of the ashwagandha other benefits that we know of in terms of being a great tonic, adaptogen, it's fabulous for anxiety and so on. And I have done a podcast as well on neuroendocrine immune botanicals, and ashwagandha is included in that. And there is another podcast on the same website for ashwagandha as well. So just a solo one for that main herb. So there's lots of benefits from those. Now, some of the backup players in the band you could consider if you needed those is black cumin seed has also been shown to be beneficial. And particularly I use black cumin seed if a patient has Hashimoto's and metabolic syndrome. It's because black cumin is great for metabolic syndrome. So that's another one you could include. And then the other thing is coleus. Coleus helps to improve cyclic AMP, which works as a secondary messenger. So basically you're going to have better activity on those thyroid hormones. So they are the main ones that I would consider, but my three, as I said, are the main sort of lead singers and work for me every time. So you can use those not only in Hashimoto's patients, but also in hypothyroid, so low thyroid function.
I'm glad ashwagandha made an appearance. I think we can't get through it without. We love ashwagandha. And, you know, as we were talking about the symptoms, of course, ashwagandha, you know, has, as an adaptogen, has so many positive and atonic effects.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned bladderwrack and its role in iodine. What other nutrients beyond iodine would you consider too, or even more about iodine as part of the kind of overall plan for those individuals with Hashimoto's?
So the research shows that there are quite a lot of nutrients that are needed for Hashimoto's. And I always like to supplement using diet and whole food nutrition. So let's be really clear, the best nutrients you can get are from good food, but also whole food nutrition. So not using isolates is my preference. So that's why I like the iodine in the herb base, or iodine from kelp, for example, rather than using a separate iodine liquid supplement, because you can actually dose too high. And I know that there is controversy around iodine dosing, and I don't want to get into an iodine debate, you know, about this. So it's very much using safe doses of iodine is my clinical preference. So the number one other nutrient is selenium, and our soils are really deficient in selenium. So that's number one. Tyrosine is a key nutrient for the thyroid. Zinc, vitamin D. I mean, what doesn't vitamin D do? So using a vitamin D complex would be ideal. Iron, if the patient needs it. So I never use iron unless I've done an iron panel and I'm really clear that the patient needs iron support. And then a whole raft of different things. Magnesium, like who doesn't need magnesium? So magnesium, manganese has been shown as well in Hashimoto's. Your B vitamins, vitamin A, C, and E, and omega-3s and probiotics. And I would always say try and get as many of these nutrients from your diet. So that's why, as I suggested earlier, cooking some food on the weekends can really help with eating at least 4 healthy meals a week. It, you know, sometimes that's all a Hashi's patient can really start with initially. And then the great thing about having lots of veggies is that you get the plant fiber, which is great for the gut. So improving the gut microbiota and the gut health overall. But having all of these nutrients is really key to supporting those nutrient deficiencies the patient may have. Meanwhile, if you support that upper gut function and improve nutrient assimilation, they'll be able to extract more of these from their food sources as well and from their whole food nutrition.
I just read, I think yesterday or the day before, that now the subclinical like deficiencies in magnesium is up to almost 60% of the population. So you weren't joking when you said who doesn't need it, right? Over half the population does.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing to hear. Thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. So I think as we were talking, you know, it's a full kind of lifestyle approach for those individuals. You know, they kind of have to wrap their minds around herbs that they need to take it stepwise, make sure that they're, you know, improving their diet overall, helping to remove any risk of toxins and other things. So really kind of like wrapping it all up, you know, what else do we need to think about with those patients beyond kind of those key things that, or maybe emphasizing some of those really key things that we need to dive deeper into?
So the key thing I've always found with Hashi's patients is that when you finally diagnose from a blood test that they've got Hashimoto's, it's almost as though they've been heard for the first time, because they may have been going to lots of different physicians and not getting any answers, and they've been feeling ghastly for a long time. So, as I said before, do the blood tests and match your symptoms up, or your clinical signs and symptoms, to understand what is the roadmap, because the blood test is not everything. So it's the first sign for you. And then using this functional herbal therapy approach together with whole food nutrition and their diet, you can really make a difference. But I would say there's a big caveat with Hashi's patients. Be patient and be kind, because there will be times when they just can't handle it. Even what you might think is a very small approach to what they've got going on, and your recommendations you might think are quite minor, may really make sure you check in with them and ensure that they are okay with this phased approach and how much you're asking them to do, not just from a supplement perspective, but from a lifestyle, food wise, etc. And what I always say to patients is text me. If it's all too much for you at any point and you can't cope and you're about to just let it all go, you know, come off the program or stop doing something food wise, please text me, because it's about a constant partnering with them initially, particularly is important, because you can really help someone, but it might take a bit more effort from you. But it's so worth it. So if you can put the effort in initially, you can really help to change that person's life and their family's life, their loved ones' lives, you know, because they are feeling so much better. So it is a puzzle, and you've got to be prepared to sort of find the pieces of the jigsaw and put them together. And at times you might think you've got the whole picture of the jigsaw and then something else goes wrong. But be patient, be understanding with yourself as well. And I'm probably making this sound too complicated, but it's really not. Once you sort of get in the groove of working with these patients, it's such a rewarding area to specialize in your practice, for example, and you will get known for this. It's amazing how people with thyroid issues all talk to each other on social media and they find you. So be really aware that this is so easy once you know these tips and tricks we've talked about today. And also if you look at my Hashimoto's masterclass presentation for doctors, you'll see even more information. But know that you can really, really, really help someone to change their life. So I really hope that you take this on and get excited about it and go forth and help many people.
Thank you so much, Amanda, for your insights. And I think we'll have the opportunity to really make a difference in many patients' lives as we think about how we approach Hashimoto's, because it is, as you said, such a complex and difficult thing for that patient. And so if you can really make a difference, it will be significant for them. So that, I want to thank you so much again for your time and the great conversation. And we will look forward to seeing you guys next time.
Cheers. Thanks so much, Sarah, and all the best.
Thank you for listening to the Holistic Matters podcast series. To learn more about thyroid health and medicinal herbs, go to holisticmatters.com. That's holistic with a W.